one of those big, massive, packed full of stuff shows for you. We're gonna be starting off with the latest on possible impeachment for Donald Trump, driven by his increasingly brazen stonewalling of virtually every avenue of congressional investigation of what he and those around him have done over the past few years. We've got developments on that, quotes from a number of Democratic representatives now pushing for impeachment, including some ones that you will certainly recognize. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be closing out the show. Stick around till the end for meanwhile in news from around the world, including a couple of good news stories. We don't always have that in meanwhile in or in the show at all, but we do have it today. And along the way, we've got three different guests who are going to be joining us to talk about a number of important issues. So in just a little bit, Marisa Endicott is going to be joining us to talk about Me Too legislation that the Democrats are pushing in the House right now, targeting workers in the service industry. Very important, could have a great impact. We'll be breaking that down. Activist Ashley Marie Preston is going to be joining us to talk about the spate of violence against transgender people of color. Another huge issue, not generally talked about very much by the media. We're going to be breaking that down, revealing what that experience is like, the numbers, all of it. And Sharon Kahn later on, the new push, especially in the South, GOP-led legislatures pushing these draconian abortion bans. How has the right-wing media been covering it? We've got a rep from Media Matters on to break it down for you. But first, domestic news. So we were supposed to have testimony of Don McGahn, former White House legal counsel. And he was supposed to come in, reveal what he knew, but Donald Trump didn't want him to, and his loyalties lie with Donald Trump. And so it didn't happen. And now with that and some judicial rulings lately that have not gone Donald Trump's way, we are ever more in a real impasse. What are the Democrats going to do to force Donald Trump and the White House more generally, the executive branch more generally, to actually comply with the balance of powers that our country relies on? And Donald Trump is showing, at least at this point, that he believes that the power lies in his hands and that he can simply do or not do whatever he wants. And that's becoming increasingly clear. So we're gonna return to Don McGahn in just a second, but I wanna talk about another development yesterday. A positive development legally that Donald Trump is responding to in a way that I find to be quite scary. So you have this effort by the Democrats to gain access to his tax returns and information about the Trump Organization. Now here, we're not talking about the avenue where they're going through the Treasury for that. In this case, through a law firm that prepared these documents. And there's a new judicial ruling on that area. Judge Amit Mehta said, "It is simply not fathomable that a constitution that grants Congress the power to remove a president for reasons including criminal behavior would deny Congress the power to investigate him for unlawful conduct, past or present, even without formally opening an impeachment inquiry." And he ordered that Trump's longstanding accounting firm, Mazars USA, produce documents it prepared for the Trump Organization going back to 2011. Now, we're not done. That's not the end of this. It will certainly be appealed, and there will be every attempt to draw this out as long as possible, literally years if necessary. Donald Trump could have already lost the 2020 election by the time this is resolved. But at least at this point, the judge is ruling on the side of the Democrats, as you would expect, considering that they have the constitutional authority, and I would say the responsibility to conduct exactly the type of oversight they're doing, especially considering all that was revealed in the Mueller report. Now, the judge has made his ruling. What does Donald Trump think about that? Well, take a look at the way he spun what happened. He said, "Well, we disagree with that ruling. It's crazy because you look at it, this never happened to any other president. They're trying to get a redo. They're trying to get what we used to call in school a deal, a do-over." We say that outside of school too. It's not a thing where you have to go back to your child in school. It's just a thing that's said. You can just say it. But anyway, so look, you have a judge who is saying they have every constitutional rationale, reason to be able to acquire these documents and look into them. They can do that. And he's saying it's crazy. It's just about the election, as if Judge Amit Mehta is a Democratic campaign strategist, some sort of operative for the party. No, that's not the case at all. But if you think it's weird that I'm making it partisan in that particular case, understand that Donald Trump did the exact same thing, saying that Mehta is an Obama-appointed judge. Now look, he didn't go much farther than that point, but it's not difficult to imagine that that is supposed to set a precedent where, well, okay, a judge ruled against us, a judge ruled that they can get these documents, but it wasn't one of my judges. So am I really going to comply with that? And if you think that he would not pursue that avenue, I don't know how much attention you've been paying to politics over the past couple of years. And so I'm very scared about that precedent, where obviously they're not complying with literally any legal requirements, subpoenas, anything like that coming from Congress. We've normalized that. We're just used to it. There's no balance of powers. We have an imperial executive branch. That's apparently what we're going to have. But at the very least, you did have the judiciary. And you had, going back the past couple of years, judges knocking down, at least temporarily, some big pushes by the Trump administration, for instance, to initially ban Muslims from entering the country. Things of that sort. The judiciary has not always been on his side. But now, if it all comes down to who appointed the judges, that seems like kind of a big issue. That seems a little bit like a constitutional crisis. We will see if that is how the Democrats respond to it. Now, at least in terms of Don McGahn choosing not to actually testify before Congress, after being badgered and pressured by Donald Trump and his cronies, we do have House Judiciary Chairman Representative Jerry Nadler, who he went to the room where there was supposed to be the testimony. He had no one to question, so instead he said this. He took to Twitter talking about Donald Trump to call Mr. McGahn a liar. His lawyers went on cable television to do the same. In short, the president took it upon himself to intimidate a witness who has a legal obligation to be here today. This conduct is not remotely acceptable, but it is remotely not surprising, I would say. This is the way that it has been going for some time. I mean, this sort of witness tampering, witness intimidation, is exactly what we were concerned about while Mueller was conducting his report. And it's the sort of obstruction of justice that was detailed ad nauseum throughout that report. We've gone over the details, I won't bore you with them again. But this belief that, no, these investigations, whether by the special counsel or by Congress, I don't need to comply with that. And you might say, well, doesn't he have to though? Because there are ramifications, there are consequences if a president does this sort of stonewalling, if he does this sort of obstruction of justice. Well, yes, hypothetically, I mean, Don McGahn could be thrown in jail, for instance. Others in the Trump administration who are not complying with these subpoenas could similarly face legal challenges. But will they? Jerry Nadler is talking a big game, and others in that committee were saying that he will be required to testify one way or another. We will wait to see what that actually looks like in practice. But right now, we have a lot more threats, a lot more flapping of the lips than actual action. And when we're talking about action, we're talking about in this area, impeachment is the big action that obviously is on people's minds. And Donald Trump has shown that all of what was revealed in the Mueller report, he doesn't care about it. He believes that part of it has exonerated him, part of it is irrelevant. And unfortunately, at this point, you need to have some sort of counterweight. You need to have someone on the Democratic side making the case strongly that if he is going to engage in these sorts of obviously criminal behaviors in terms of obstruction of justice and stonewalling Congress, that impeachment has to be on the table. But right now, the leader is Nancy Pelosi, and she is not a fan of that. But thankfully, especially as more and more of these developments are happening with Don McGahn, his response to Judge Mehta, other Democrats are picking up, I would say, the mantle of leadership when it has been abdicated by people like Nancy Pelosi. And so you have some names that you're probably familiar with, some that you might not be, but I want to give you a diverse range of perspectives on this. We had Justin Amash yesterday, Republican, saying that Donald Trump had obviously the things he had done rise to the level of impeachment. But we have a number of Democrats too. Representative Mark Pocan saying stonewalling Congress on witnesses and the unredacted Mueller report only enhances the president's appearance of guilt. And as a result, he has pushed Congress to a point where we must start an impeachment inquiry. We also have Representative Veronica Escobar, who said, I personally feel like we cannot tolerate this level of obstruction, that if we do, then we have lowered the bar to the point where any criminal can be president of the United States, and that should be unacceptable to all of us. I believe we need to begin an impeachment inquiry. We have Ilhan Omar, who responded to Justin Amash, again, Republican congressman's comments, by saying, this isn't about politics, it's about the fate of our nation. Remember that for a second. We're gonna return to that it's not about politics point, because she might have been responding to a particular individual. And then you also have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So she was asked, I believe earlier today, about this. Take a look at what she said.
You know, I trust the speaker is taking a measured approach to ensure that we're moving everyone forward. I know that, you know, being a speaker is hard. Holding this party together is a difficult task, but I think that we have to do. I personally think that I think we have to move forward.
Okay, so obviously it was very difficult to actually hear that. I don't know why they weren't balancing the sound between those two scenes in a more favorable way for the person who's actually talking, but what she says is, on the one hand, I get that it's a difficult balance that the speaker has to maintain, but that we have to move forward on this. Now that's interesting, because if you just read the literal words of it, she's very supportive of Speaker Pelosi, but she knows what Pelosi's position on this is. It doesn't matter what Donald Trump does. Pelosi comes out every day and says, here's another thing Donald Trump did that deserves or merits impeachment, but we're not going to push for that. AOC knows that. So she speaks in a deferential way towards Nancy Pelosi while also pushing for a policy that's diametrically opposed to Pelosi's political strategy for the next 18 months or so. And I think that that's important. She's obviously one of the most out front, visible members of the Democratic caucus. Anything she says is going to be big news. And so she words it very carefully, but pushes in the right direction. Now, while all of this is going on over the past 24 hours, Nancy Pelosi has been facing increasing pressure to do something about this. And I'm not going to go through all the details of the behind closed doors meetings, but I just want a little bit. So in a Democratic Steering and Policy Committee meeting, Representative Steve Cohen of Tennessee stood up and demanded Trump's impeachment. Pelosi countered, quote, "This is not about politics, it's about what's best for the American people," said a member who attended the meeting. So this is not about politics. Remember, Ilhan Omar said, this isn't about politics, this is about the fate of our nation. But AOC, again, I can't say that this is a response specifically to what Nancy Pelosi was talking about, but it is an interesting philosophical distinction between them. When she tweeted, "It is just as politicized a maneuver to not impeach in the face of overwhelming evidence as it is to impeach without cause. Congress swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. That includes impeachment. We have a duty to preserve our institutions and uphold the rule of law." And here's the thing. There have been cases in the past where we have talked about impeachment as a country in cases where it wasn't necessarily necessary. The crimes or the allegations had not risen to that level. And we know that back in the 90s, it was used in a ridiculously partisan way as part of a sort of sexual counterstrike to Bill Clinton. But in this case, nobody appears to actually dispute the evidence, including some Republicans. Nancy Pelosi isn't saying Donald Trump hasn't broken the law, he hasn't committed these crimes. She's just saying, "I think it would hurt us to actually pursue doing anything about it. And so I would rather let the American people decide in a year and a half." And who cares what Donald Trump does between now and then, the executive orders he passes, the legislation he pushes for, foreign policy moves he makes. We could end up in a war with Iran by then. She is simply saying, we can't afford to be bold in this area, we must wait. And I would say, considering the approach that has become incredibly clear from the Trump administration, from the White House, from the executive branch, if you want to have Democratic control of the House mean literally anything between now and then, you are obligated to pursue impeachment, let alone the constitutional requirement, the responsibility that you hold, the fact that the evidence is so incredibly clear. You're not going to be passing legislation between now and the next election. The Senate, Mitch McConnell, they're going to make sure that that doesn't happen. So you have to perform the role that is available to you, that is oversight. And if you are not going to push for impeachment in this case, and you are going to allow them to stonewall you, to not provide documents, to not provide witnesses, none of that. What is the point of this majority for the next 18 months? What did all of those individuals campaign for so long and so hard? What did the activists push for? What were the donations for? What was any of it for? If you're saying the next year and a half, Trump, just do what you want and we'll see what happens in November. That is completely unacceptable to me, to a large percentage of the country, and thankfully to an increasing number of Democrats in the House. And I hope that they win the day. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. A number of guests are going to be joining us. Very important topics. We'll see you on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
After endless months of hardcore effort by journalists, women activists, a number of people involved in the Me Too movement, what have the actual legal implications of that been? What actual progress on the books have we gotten? It turns out there is a bill, and we're going to talk about how important it might be. We're joined now by editorial fellow and Mother Jones, Marisa Endicott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. And I want to talk about this bill. So Democratic lawmakers have a bill hoping to provide additional protections, particularly for people in the service industry. Now, I come up through the service industry, so I have a little bit more understanding of how rough an area that can be necessarily. But it is particularly hard on women that are serving in those sorts of jobs. Can you talk a little bit about why that's an important industry to provide, to have specific protections added in?
Sure. So the service industry, and particularly the restaurant industry, is a huge industry in the U.S. It employs 13 million workers. It's one of the fastest growing in the private sector. It also has a very large number of women, people of color, immigrants, people who tend to be particularly vulnerable to harassment. And, you know, as a lot of the news coverage has revealed, people working in the restaurant industries experience, and other service industries as well, experience a really high level of sexual harassment.
Yeah, and in your piece at Mother Jones, you talk about how, I mean, we're familiar with some of the more public jobs in the service industry, but there are people who go to people's homes and work in their homes. It's very private, and they can be victimized without necessarily anyone knowing about it. And some of the examples that you list are just horrendous. And so, with this bill that was announced last month, what do the Democrats actually want to do to change the situation?
Yeah, so it's a really kind of sweeping bill, but the parts that are particularly interesting are the protections for low-wage workers. One of, I'd say, the most interesting protections that they're looking to push forward is getting rid of the tipped federal minimum wage. So in the U.S., we actually have the federal minimum wage, which is about $7.25, and then there's the tip minimum wage, which is for workers who receive tips. They have a much lower minimum wage, which is just $2.13 an hour. And 17 states adhere to this lower minimum wage for tipped workers. And then there's 7 states that actually require that tipped workers have the same minimum wage as all other workers. And then the rest of the states are somewhere in between. So that means in the majority of the country, tipped employees are under immense pressure to keep the customer happy at all costs. And that results in a lot higher risk of harassment. And so basically, this bill would get rid of the federal tip minimum wage altogether.
And of course, they have to keep the customers happy, but also in some of these examples, their money is being sort of routed through a manager perhaps. So it provides additional financial power that these people have over someone who that's their income. The actual check that they'll get on their actual wage. I mean, as a former waiter, I know that $2.13 sounds bad, but it actually works out to basically nothing because your taxes take away all of that. All of it is tips in the end. So in terms of actual ability to have some sort of legal strike back against managers or people in positions of authority who are abusing these people, are there teeth to the legislation in that area?
Yeah, so I would say there's quite a few actual processes that this bill would implement. There's legal grants to help low-wage workers, low-income workers actually file claims against their employers. There's an expansion of, there's limits to things like non-disclosure agreements. And I would say one of the biggest benefits would be, and this touches on something you mentioned before, where you have a lot of situations where you have domestic workers or small businesses where it's just a few employees and there's like a lot less oversight. this bill would expand the coverage of the Civil Rights Act. So under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, employers are prevented from discriminating against their employees on the basis of race, sex, religion, and that includes protections against sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. But as it stands, that only applies to businesses with 15 or more employees. So you have huge swaths of the working population that have no ability to file federal claims. One congressional report actually found that 10 to 17% of workers are unable to file federal claims under Title VII because of the fact that they are part of small businesses and that kind of thing. So this would be a pretty big game changer to expand those rights to people like interns, independent contractors, house cleaners, you know, quite a few.
There was one other area I was curious about, though, because in particular, some of the industries that you're talking about, it might be the case that people with, like, what I'm wondering is immigration status, how that intersects with some of these industries, and where you have financial vulnerability, you also have vulnerability perhaps legally, where you're worried about what might happen. It seems like that's a community that would be even more vulnerable to the harassment and abuse of various sorts. Does the legislation include considerations for people of varying immigration statuses?
That's a really good point. So there is an expansion of protections for immigrants as well. I'm not sure how far that goes, but definitely, as you said, there's particularly like farm workers and domestic workers, you know, there's a lot of them will be facing, are particularly vulnerable because of their immigration status, and as well as language barriers and other vulnerabilities. And so I do know that this expands by expanding the the coverage of the Title VII, they will get further protection as well as being able to access kind of like these grants or sources of like legal protections and legal advice that should help to protect at least some of these people who have definitely been left out.
Well, that is very good news. And, you know, I would like to imagine that we live in a world where Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate will give this legislation a serious look. Hopefully that will be the case. I don't necessarily, I'm not willing to bet on that necessarily, but I appreciate both your write-up, which is available at Mother Jones. People should go take a look at that for more examples of how this would actually impact individuals' lives. But Marisa, we really appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more to get to. Over the weekend, a 23-year-old transgender woman named Malaysia Booker was shot and killed. And this is something that has become all too common for individuals across the country of this community. But even in particular for Malaysia Booker, who had herself been the target of abuse and violence in recent months. And this is something that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. And so I want to talk about it. And we're going to be joined now by media personality and civil rights activist Ashley Marie Preston to break this down. Ashley Marie, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So this particular case with Malaysia Booker, who was killed over the weekend, had previously been attacked brutally. When you read about this news, what did you feel initially?
It was gut-wrenching. I think that it's a constant reminder that our local and federal government contends to let the transgender community down, more specifically Black trans women. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of what kind of numbers we're looking at here, the Human Rights Campaign kept track of the murders of trans people from the year 2013 until 2017. Of the 102 transgender people who were murdered, 86% of them were Black trans women. And just last year alone, there were 26 trans murders. And of those 26, 20 were Black, and 19 of them were Black trans women.
Exactly. Those numbers are absolutely horrendous for the community specifically. And in terms of the violence, so I was doing research on trying to find out how pervasive the murders, obviously, we're seeing increasing numbers, absolutely horrendous. But even below the level of murder, I saw in 13 southern states, 47% of transgender people reported high levels of violence by strangers. Almost half, complete strangers, not just abuse and harassment, which would be horrendous enough, but actual violence. And And so that's...
But it's not just there even. So we aren't experiencing violence only at the hands of strangers. And that same report, they reported that 52% of police officers had harassed and abused them, and a whopping 40% of healthcare providers. Physically, yes, and verbally abused them. So we're looking at marginalization in every single space we occupy within society, which is essentially the textbook definition of marginalization.
And so when these murders happen, people don't really talk about them. It doesn't make much news, even though it's an obvious trend that's very clear to see. And in the case of this individual, so previously she had been beaten by this individual on camera, Edward Thomas. He was charged with aggravated assault. It's not a hate crime to specifically target members of the community in that state. What do you think about that, about the lack of legal representation of the particular threat that is faced?
Well, I think going back to what I was saying a moment ago, it's a constant reminder that our state and federal local officials aren't very supportive of trans people. So when you have the US government refusing to respect the dignity of Black trans women, that sentiment trickles down into our very immediate social ecology. And so people take their social cues from the government. So until we start putting legislation and regulations in place that hold them accountable for such egregious behavior, we're going to continue to see an uptick of violence.
And the depressing thing is that in the particular states where some of this violence is most pervasive, not in all cases, but in some, you have Republican governors, you have a Republican president who seem little inclined to even think about this problem. You've talked about how this is an especially a problem for Black transgender women. Why is it that community in particular is so victimized?
Well, I think there's a larger conversation to be had about our experiences at the intersections of race, gender, and socioeconomic disparity. So a very basic textbook definition of intersectionality describes multiple threats of discrimination when an individual's identities overlap with multiple marginalized groups. Mm-hmm. So as a Black trans woman, I'm never going to experience racism on a single axis, but I'm going to experience racism, sexism, and transphobia simultaneously. And so that definitely contributes to the staggering percentages that we've been talking about so far.
So we saw a few examples of politicians, including Elizabeth Warren, tweeting about this particular murder and appearing to take it seriously. If we lived in a world where it seems crazy, but politicians just accepted that the brutalization and harassment and murder of members of this community is an objective bad thing that needs to be stopped. And if you were in charge of passing laws to make that the case, what would you like to see happen? Where do we need to get to?
I would definitely like to see us move away from catch-all advocacy, because catch-all advocacy still leaves many of us falling through the cracks. We need to have elected officials in office who are going to prioritize the needs of historically disenfranchised people, such as Black and brown trans women. I definitely think that we need to have more social programs that are geared toward securing housing, employment, secondary education, healthcare, and all of those additional needs that trans women, more specifically Black trans women, have barriers to accessing.
You know, and I'm also curious for people who might be inclined in terms of their values, their political ideology, to be at least what they think of on the right side of this particular issue. That doesn't mean that, as you point out, in terms of intersectionality, they can get it wrong and they can say things without understanding what they're saying. For people who want to be good allies, do you have any advice in terms of what they might be getting wrong in thought or word or deed in this area?
I think going back to the area of opportunity I mentioned for the federal government, which is moving away from catch-all advocacy, there seems to be this All Lives Matter-esque kind of vibe that goes on when we talk about social injustices. And so when we talk about privilege, more specifically privilege, people freeze up and they're like, well, I don't have a private island and a mansion up in the hills or a brand new BMW, but privilege isn't really about what you've experienced, it's about what you haven't experienced. And so even in the LGBTQ community, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, which kicked off a great portion of the queer liberation movement. And yet, I still have to have conversations with gay white men explaining to them that I'm not saying as a gay white man, you don't have problems. What I'm saying is that your gender and your race aren't one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when we're talking about specifically allies who want to get involved and they want to help, we can't frame it unless we name it. When we're having these conversations, we need to be able to say Black. We need to be able to say transgender. We need to name it instead of being intellectually lazy and lumping it into the overall advancement of people in general, because we all aren't on an even even playing field.
I think that that's fantastic advice. Ashley Marie Preston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, big draconian abortion bans passing in multiple states throughout the country. We're going to be talking about how the right has been communicating about this, how excited they are after this. Across the country, multiple states are passing absolutely draconian abortion bans. Some not quite full bans, but that's the goal. And some, they're just dispensing with the, the subtlety, and they're just banning it outright. And while they're doing that, the right-wing media is just loving it. And joining us now to break down what they're saying, how they're communicating around this issue, is Sharon Kahn, Abortion Rights and Reproductive Health Program Director at Media Matters. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Always glad to have someone from Media Matters. We appreciate the work you guys do every day. And so overall, how excited would you say the right-wing media is about this new push to get Roe v. Wade overturned?
I think the easiest way to put it is that they're very excited. We've seen, pretty much since the beginning of the year when I think abortion became more centered in both right-wing and traditional media coverage, a conversation happening on Fox News and right-wing media celebrating the potential end of Roe v. Wade. Although we know that Roe isn't overturned yet, I think that they are pretty much reading the cards on the table and are very excited about it.
And so just to be really clear on that point, so you have these individual bills, but many of them, they are obviously unconstitutional, I think, to any reasonable person. So is it clear from how they're communicating, the right-wing media personalities on TV, online, that this is ultimately not about those bills, that it's about getting it to the Supreme Court, and that they think they've got the numbers now to finally end Roe v. Wade?
I think it's pretty clear. We've seen both people explicitly saying that now Roe is on the table, and then we've seen some more subtle kind of hints at it. I think a good example of that would be we see the leader of anti-abortion organizations going on Fox News and saying things like Roe is about to be a footnote in history. We've also seen throughout the year, but especially now that states are really stepping up and passing more abortion bans, we've seen a lot of Fox News commentators and right-wing media writ large saying that they think things are going in the right direction or lauding the progress that states are making in restricting abortion.
So on your write-up on Media Matters, you have quotes from a number of different personalities. You have people on Fox News, you have people like Ben Shapiro, a pretty wide range. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, I've been reading about the heartbeat bill. I hate calling it that because it's ridiculous mm-hmm. and it's not anatomically correct, but that's what they call it. About how those had been considered, even by relative extremists in the anti-abortion movement just a few years ago, that was too extreme. Now you have laws where there's no exceptions for rape and incest. Those sorts of relative nuances or subtleties in the position, are we still seeing that in the commentators? Are they saying that these bills might be going a little bit too far in some of the details, or are they just all in on criminalization from top to bottom?
I think that there probably are some nuances in terms of how particular personalities might be messaging it, but I do think that the overwhelming preponderance of people in right-wing media and in the anti-abortion movement are pretty much on board. There has been a shift in some of the politics of anti-abortion groups. For example, the Ohio Right to Life chapter that previously had said something like a 6-week ban was too extreme is now on board. So there have been shifts like that. But I do think that right-wing media overall, even if they might want to quibble about some of the specifics of the bills, are all in lockstep on the ultimate messaging and the goal, which is to criminalize abortion.
And there's one area about the messaging about abortion right now that has become quite common that I've seen. And I'm curious, you have a more broad approach to the media, but even Donald Trump at his rallies has been spreading these myths about infanticide, about the child being birthed and swaddled and then murdered. How common has that become? Is that a thing where Donald Trump is sort of a standout, or is that a trope that we're seeing pretty broadly now?
That's the thing that we are seeing very broadly. And Donald Trump, I feel fairly confident saying, probably got it from Fox News, because before the State of the Union, after New York and Virginia passed progressive abortion legislation or tried to, you know, there was an outcry from Fox News. I think before the State of the Union, they spent something like 6.5 hours talking about the sensationalized and inaccurate talking points about infanticide. And then Trump parroted that in the State of the Union and has now made it part of every stump speech he's given. I think it's indicative of a pretty clear pipeline between right-wing media and Fox News in particular and the presidency. And we see that reflected in policy and in rhetoric.
And I'm also curious, I'm interested in the Venn diagram of the more explicitly Christian right-wing programming and those that aren't explicitly, like some of the commentators on Fox News. In terms of grounding the case for why abortion should be banned in the Bible or religion or some idea of whether accurate or not, and I don't believe it's accurate, and an idea of what the Bible says about abortion, is that still a big part of it, or have they moved to more sort of generalized concern for the sanctity of life, but not explicitly tied to Christianity?
I think it's both and. I think you'll see outlets that do couch their concerns in terms of like explicit biblical passages or in terms of specific biblical ideas. I do think that even those groups and organizations that do that have made an effort to reach out to what they would call more secular media organizations to try and cross message. So although I do think we are seeing some expansion, that is very present in a lot of the messaging still.
So it seemed like for the past couple of years, a lot of the sort of electoral strategy of communication on the right around winning elections has been about immigration, caravans, the border, you know, fears about that. This seems like a pretty strong push to like politics circa 10, 15 years ago, where you focus on issues like abortion more. Do you see this being sustainable, that going through this interminable presidential election that we're in, that this will be a big part of the right-wing strategy to turn out the vote in 2020?
I think it'll be a huge part of the right-wing strategy, and I think that they have told us so. We've seen, from the beginning of this year alone, we've seen an anti-abortion talking points, and not just talking points, sensationalized and harmful tropes about abortion and people who have them, present at not just the State of the Union, but at every stump speech, at CPAC. And then we've seen it continue in terms of the stories that get picked up from right-wing media and Fox News. I don't think it's a drumbeat that's going away, and I think they've telegraphed their intentions to make it sort of something that could be teed up consistently, you know, for the next year at least.
And so I'm almost a little bit scared to ask this, but so you guys at Media Matters, you look at a wide range of media sources for the right, and we know that information goes from like the darkest depths of like 4chan and websites like it to Fox News and Breitbart and then to the president in what feels like 24 hours. So we've got the infanticides, which seems like the most absurd, disgusting misinformation possible. Do you have a preview of anything else that's working its way up that we should be concerned about that'll be a part of this conversation soon?
I think something that's working its way up has been the narrative about abortion extremism and about sort of bias in the media that's not letting you see that alleged extremism. A good example of this is, you know, The Federalist had an article today that actually I think they had somebody on CNN or MSNBC to talk about it, where they said that, you know, the reason why people don't realize how pro-life the country is because feminists and pro-abortion people control the media. Now, the accurate spin on that is that that's not accurate, that part of the reason why they don't see those values reflected is because we know that a majority of the country does favor Roe remaining on the books, does favor access to safe legal abortion. But I think that we'll see a continuation of this messaging that, you know, Democrats are extreme or people who support access to abortion as healthcare are extreme. And I think it'll be messaged in a lot of different ways.
Okay, so something to look forward to. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Sharon Khan, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. Just for a few minutes, let's set aside the disaster that is American politics and focus on disasters around the globe in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Australia, I love the reclining kangaroo. We actually have some good news. In an election that was generally just the worst, there was a good result. Far-right Senator Fraser Anning was voted out of Australia's parliament just 2 months after he made international headlines for blaming the New Zealand mosque attacks on Muslim immigration. Just a little section of what he put out, a long statement on official letterhead. Part of it was, the real cause of bloodshed on New Zealand streets today is the immigration program which allowed Muslim fanatics to migrate to New Zealand in the first place. And in case you've forgotten the details of that, it was not perpetrated by Muslim fanatics or Muslims at all. They were the victims. And he was confused about that too, but not necessarily about the wording. He specifically said that the people who had just been murdered could not be considered victims. He's objectively one of the worst people in world politics. And so thankfully, he has moved on, no longer in elected office in Australia, probably soon to be given a commentator spot on Fox News. Meanwhile, in Taiwan, also good news with the legalization of same-sex marriage. On May 17th, 2019 in Taiwan, #LoveOne, we took a big step towards true equality and made Taiwan a better country, one tweet said. And the same-sex marriage statute passed in Taiwan sends an important message to the world that the LGBTQ plus community is not intruding into Asian cultures, and LGBTQ plus rights can coexist peacefully with traditional Asian values. Now, it's not like the full resolution of the situation there. There's still discrimination, harassment, a variety of different ways that that community is still victimized by that government, as they are by virtually every government across the world. And it is just the beginning of that region moving in this direction. But it is progress. It is moving in the right direction. And it is good to see that sort of progress moving into new areas of the world. Hopefully, just one step among many that will happen in the near future. Meanwhile, in a UK politician got hit by a milkshake, and it's pretty funny. Not to them, obviously. Let's start from the beginning. Brexit Party leader Nigel Farage, who you're probably familiar with, had been campaigning in the city of Newcastle for only about 20 minutes on Monday when a man hurled a drink at him, covering his suit in a sticky liquid that the attacker later confirmed was a banana and salted caramel milkshake from Five Guys that cost him £5.25, about $6.68. I love that they included that details in the story. But yes, okay, so Nigel Farage, a guy who's incredibly xenophobic, anti-Islam, pushed for Brexit, all that stuff, really bad guy, got a milkshake thrown at him. Now, I am not in favor of pelting people with milkshakes. It is a waste of a good milkshake. And also, you shouldn't do it. If I had just gotten my suit dry cleaned and someone hit me with a shake, I would not be happy about it. I understand that. And it's bad. And it shouldn't continue, but some people on the right have been going to crazy lengths to turn this into basically their elevation to official victimhood status. So take a look at an example. Burger King tweeted, "Dear people of Scotland, we're selling milkshakes all week. Have fun, love BK, #JustSaying," which is, it's from the Burger King UK account. I think objectively what that is one of those things where a brand tries to be fun and hip and they're talking about stuff that's in the news. Maybe this isn't when they should be doing it, but again, this is a guy who's despised around the world, despised there, so they're taking that as a place to make a joke. That is not how the right accepted it, and there are articles everywhere, Red State and Breitbart and Twitter accounts and all that. Burger King is advocating for political violence. Shakes today, bricks tomorrow is what they're saying. Saying, today it's shakes, tomorrow one person dies, the next day many die. Here's the thing, you jokers. There is political violence. People have been killed. Heather Hare was murdered by a Nazi in the US, and you guys were silent about that. You're silent about people leaving Trump rallies, hunting down immigrants and beating the hell out of them. You're silent about all of that sort of victimization. People being killed at the border because of our ridiculous lack of concern and compassion for people making that difficult trip from Central and Southern America up to the US. There's all sorts of political violence. Most of it doesn't come in the form of a sticky banana and salted caramel milkshake. And perhaps if you had shown a little bit of concern for the people who were being beaten and murdered all along the way by people who are white supremacists and Nazis and extremists of that sort, whether in the US where they're gunning down people in synagogues or in New Zealand where they're gunning down people in mosques, maybe we would have a little bit less of a sense of humor on the whole milkshake thing and would have a little bit more solidarity. So again, there should be no violence, nobody should be punched, nobody should be shaked, but let's keep things in perspective. There are shakes and there are murders, and those are very much not the same thing. Okay, that's meanwhile in. I have a few more seconds, and so I'll just end by revealing to people who made it all the way through the podcast a little bit of a personal note on how my life is going. I had been wishing over the past 24 to 48 hours that AOC, one of my favorite people in the world, would tweet a little bit about Game of Thrones. Be careful what you wish for. She didn't like the finale, and now my heart is absolutely broken. In a video that she recorded with Elizabeth Warren, which we'll probably play on the show tomorrow, she talked about how dissatisfied she was with the resolutions, the storylines of Daenerys and Sansa. And now I'm just overall sad about the state of the world. So That's where I'm at. Hopefully you're in a better spot thanks to the news we covered today. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.